Long before Luke Skywalker wielded a lightsaber and long before sequels became an all-powerful force, another science fiction franchise was beginning its maiden voyage into television and pop culture history. Today on Present at the Creation, Morning Edition boldly explores Star Trek. The original series spawned 4 additional TV shows, 9, soon to be 10, movies, dozens of books, and more annual conventions than you can shake a tribble at. It's hard to believe that more than 35 years ago, the first Star Trek series was a flop. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
It's possible now to rent the video of the first Star Trek pilot, The Cage, which was never seen in its original form until the 1980s, when Star Trek's creator, the late Gene Roddenberry, introduced the video to the public.
You were the ones who said it first. Star Trek lives, and live it does. For over 2 decades it has. But now I want to take you back to a time when the Enterprise and Spock and Kirk and all the rest were just part of an idea I had. Back to the beginnings of Star Trek. To the first Star Trek pilot.
The first pilot was rejected in 1965. Again, Gene Roddenberry.
I wanted to sell my series, so I had promised the network that my Star Trek idea would be little more than a space western. A wagon train to the stars. Zap guns instead of six-shooters. Spaceships instead of horses.
But Roddenberry said he wanted to talk about love, war, sex, nature, God, the entire human condition. And he thought if he dressed it up with aliens...
Maybe the TV censors would let it pass because it all seemed so make-believe.
Roddenberry, who died in 1991, said the network had disliked many aspects of his show. That he put a woman on the bridge of a starship. That he had a racially mixed crew. That he had an alien crew member. And that none of the crew members smoked. In a time when tobacco advertising was key to network profits. He reworked the pilot and the show was on.
Space. The final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
The first episode that aired was called The Man Trap, and many of the themes were already there. For example, the complex encounters between the logical Vulcan Spock and other crew members, in this case, Communications Officer Lieutenant Uhura.
Ms. Uhura, your last subspace log contained an error in the frequencies column.
Mr. Spock, sometimes I think if I hear that word frequency once more, I'll cry.
Cry?
I was just trying to start a conversation.
Well, since it is illogical for a communications officer to resent the word frequency, I have no answer.
No, you have an answer. I'm an illogical woman who's beginning to feel too much a part of that communications council. Why don't you tell me I'm an attractive young lady or ask me if I've ever been in love? Tell me how your planet Vulcan looks on a lazy evening when the moon is full.
Vulcan has no moon, Miss Uhura.
I'm not surprised, Mr. Spock.
Majel Barrett, who was the nurse on the Enterprise in the original series, went on to marry Gene Roddenberry. Remembering back, she says, no one thought the show would fly.
We got there in the morning, we put our makeup on, we got our clothes on, we set our lines, we took our makeup off and went home. Remember, we were actors doing a show, and the show was a flop, and the show was going to be canceled anyways.
She says neither the actors nor the television executives thought Star Trek would be successful, and after 3 years, the show was canceled. The ratings were never very good, and it was before the networks had mastered the study of demographics, which might have told them they had a young, loyal, commercially savvy audience. The show was syndicated in the early 70s, and that's when it took off. But Barrett remembers the shock she and her fellow actors experienced when they would wander into Star Trek conventions in the mid-70s and find tens of thousands of people applauding them. Now, although she is the producer of Andromeda and many other enterprises, she says...
I don't even go near Star Trek shows now. They pay me. That's the absolute truth. That's all I know about Star Trek is I get a check all the time.
While the television show with Kirk and Spock and Dr. McCoy and Scotty and Uhura and Chekhov and the others was clearly the beginning of Star Trek, it's not the only beginning that's important. From the letter-writing campaigns that kept the first series on the air to the fanzines and conventions that followed, Trek and Trekkers would not exist today without the beginning of Star Trek fandom. Deborah Langsam created one of the first fanzines, Spockanalia, devoted, of course, to Spock, and she was one of the hard workers who helped create the first Star Trek convention. They got 700 pre-registrations.
We thought, oh, great, we're going to pay the bills. You know, this isn't that nice. But in point of fact, we probably had about 3,400 people. We ran out of everything. We were cutting up pieces of paper and sticking little gold seals on them and writing Star Trek and pinning them to people with straight pins.
Langsam looks back these days and says there are now people who, when they think of Star Trek, they think of the four subsequent shows: Star Trek The Next Generation, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Voyager, and Enterprise. And some of them don't know anything about the first series, Classic Trek.
Classic Trek went on for years and years, and there was nothing else. Then they brought the new ones in, and it's gotten a little antiquated, a little old-fashioned. But it was the one I loved best.
Star Trek has been shown in more than 100 countries, in over 50 languages. In 35 years, sales from licensed products have reached more than $3.5 billion. John Ordover is an executive editor at the Star Trek division of Simon & Schuster. They publish between 40 and 50 new Star Trek books a year. Ordover says Star Trek endures for a very simple reason.
If I say the fairy tale world, you know exactly what I mean. It has dragons, it has knights, it has witches, it has princesses, you know the whole shtick. Star Trek set out to build a world. And the single most unique thing about it was, unlike Tolkien's Middle Earth, which is the past, or fairy tales, which is just sort of other, and also a bit of the past, Star Trek said, you can grow to this. It's in the future. It's not in the past. It's something that can be achieved and might be achieved. It projected a future where there wasn't a big nuclear war that killed everybody, where we went out, where we had good values, and we spread those out. And some of the messages the original series had seem a bit heavy-handed now, but at the time needed to be said the way they were said.
And remember, back in 1966, deep in the Cold War, a few years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, belief in the future was not the easiest thing to come by. Again, Deborah Langsam.
Star Trek gave us a feeling that there was something to look forward to, that maybe our children would have a chance to grow up, that we weren't going to all glow in the dark. And it was very hopeful.
Ironic, isn't it? Way back in the 20th century, the H-bomb was the ultimate weapon, their doomsday machine. And we used something like it to destroy another doomsday machine. Probably the first time such a weapon has ever been used for constructive purposes.
Appropriate, Captain. However, I can't help wondering if there are any more of those weapons wandering around the universe.
A number of writers have noted that we may owe Star Trek the current look of some of our cell phones, computer and hospital monitors, the name of the first space shuttle, not to mention university courses in Klingon and 3D chess. But belief in the future may be a greater legacy. As Roger Nygaard, the director of the documentary Trekkies, wrote in the Los Angeles Times, there are worse things to be obsessed with than a TV show that has that kind of underlying message.
Scotty, beat me up.
Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.